Session number 11607, Joe Neighbours, Reel 4.
Oh, I probably, if I sat and thought a little bit, if somebody else, I think sometimes if you had two flight nurses that had been together in the same, we would say, remember, when, and they would say, oh, yes, yes, that's right. That's true.
I'm going to change focus just a little bit.
All right.
And see if there were anything that maybe you could have changed about your time as a flight nurse during the war. What might you have to do?
I think that as far as flight school, that was fine, but I don't think it prepared us for really the actual battle, you know, the actual type of patients that we would be encountering mm-hmm. and bringing back. Mm-hmm. I think if we'd had more training in that sense, as far as dengue fever and the other tropical diseases that we had to take courses at the college, I thought that was fine, but I thought that they should have made the flight course a little longer as far as what do you do in emergencies. You know, we did have training as far as when we got to Hickam, or even when we were at Bowman. I can't remember where it was they took us, but there was a ship in harbor, and we had to climb up the rope and then jump. Climb up the side of it. This was one of our tests that we had to pass. And then when we got to Hickam, they did give us, take us out to Diamond Head on a ship. It was craft, really. And then you had to jump overboard and inflate the life raft. We had to do all that. It was a ditching type of exercise. But it wasn't that... It was done, but it was done in a sense that, well, you know, this is how you do it, and that's it. Well, you know, just doing it once doesn't really, it doesn't help, because when that plane's going down, that's the last thing you think about. And when I was told, when I took this one flight, and when they told me I was to jump, ditch first, and take the life raft with me, and open that up, and then, and set up the radio, and do all this, then I was to start evacuating the patients. Well, they said I would have enough time, but when I've seen some of these airplanes go down, I think you don't have that much time. So you were to save the walking patients first. They were to get off after you got off. The crew was first if the crew could get out. If the crew couldn't get out, I wasn't to worry about the crew. I was to worry about myself and then get the patients out and set up the SOS radio system and get all the food rations and everything and see if my first aid kit was all complete. And, of course, you had to check that before you went out on every flight.
You're talking about your medical kit, or is this an additional
first aid kit? An additional first aid kit that's right on, that stays. That's right, that stays right in there. And that's the kit that you would have a knife to do anything. You'd have splints and all that, you know, that you would need. It would be a separate kit. It had a compass.
Not
a lot of.
Survival kit.
It's really a survival kit, yes, but with a lot of first aid materials in it. And I feel that we should have had a little more training in that sense.
Sounds like maybe what you did have lacked some in realism.
It did. We didn't have much. Until you actually, see, I think that we should have been sent, we should have had somebody with us on some of these trips that we could have, you know, and had someone say, well, now this is what you're supposed to do. I think when you're sent out on a flight and you know you've got a load of patients who are injured, soldiers that are injured, and you had to check all this stuff, and you're up there alone. And I don't think it's fair to say to a 21-year-old, 22-year-old girl, this is your responsibility to get this plane down, to get this life raft out and ditch, because I think at that time, I don't know whether I was mature enough to say, would I save myself before? I don't think I would. Every time I think about it, I think, would I have saved myself?
It's always kind of been a dilemma, I think, especially for nurses.
That's right.
Now, did you ever, did the emergency procedures change at all if it were you and one of the, say, male technicians or one of the sergeants on board the plane?
No, it was still the flight nurse first. She was to be the one that was
not
expendable.
No
matter what happened, I was the one that I was responsible, and I had to get out of the plane first. And whatever happened, it was my responsibility, nobody else's.
I see.
And that's where I felt that sometimes that it was a little bit difficult to make a decision. How could you make a decision like that? And I always used to say to my commander when I came in, he'd say, well, how was the flight? The time we ditched, when I was preparing to ditch, when they said that propeller was off, and he said to me, well, what were you going to do? I said, I'll tell you right now what I was going to do. I said, I was going to shove all the boys that were able to go first out the door, and then I said I would throw the raft down, and then I said I would get, because I said, I'll tell you, that water in the Pacific was so high, the waves were so high, I said, I could never open that raft myself. I said, oh, 5'2", and I only weighed 102 pounds then. And I thought, I couldn't do it. And he'd laugh. He'd say, well, the good Lord has to be looking out for you. And I'd say, yes, plus my rosary beads. That was a standing joke. I always had my rosary beads with me.
Oh, goodness. Can you think of anything else besides that?
Well, we did have two or three weddings.
Yeah, I heard
there.
Y'all had a pretty good rate of
love. We did. Marriages over there. There was, let's see, in Hickenfield there was Madeline Moon. No, Madeline, yes. Moon got married. Sackard got married. Liberty Lee. No, it wasn't Liberty Lee. It was another girl. But there were four weddings, I think. Four weddings. Oh, there was loads of fellows that would marry the girls at a drop of a hat. They were really in great demand, really and truly.
The odds were good.
The odds were very good. If you were a female, you know, they talk about going to Alaska today. Well, at that time during World War II, I think, go to Hickenfield because the field was wide open. There were a lot of good-looking young men out there. They really did. And I think that, and in fact, a lot of those marriages stayed. Now, there's Stone, Irene Stone. Now, she just died, but she and her husband, she found him out there. And Moon, she's still living. Her name was Madeline. Wasn't Moon. I can't think of her name. I probably have to see it in the book. But anyhow, she's married and she's still living. She and her husband are still married, same man. Of course, I've been married 43 years, so we're still together. We have two lovely girls and five grandchildren. And I have a grandson that's graduating this year and going to Ohio State in the fall, so, yeah.
Based on the experiences that you had as a flight nurse during World War II, can you think of any advice that you might like to pass on to flight nurses today or to those who might be called to serve as a flight nurse in a future war? We, of course, hope there wouldn't be one, but if the event should occur, what from your own experience might you want to pass on?
Well, I'm trying to think. The only thing I can think of is to pick up all the knowledge you can ahead of time of the area you're going into. To have a good sense of humor, to love your fellow man, to get as much medical background as you can, to get as much education as you can, and to be yourself. You have to love your fellow man and have a lot of compassion and be always optimistic and have a smile. Those, I think, are the requisites that I would say would make a good flight nurse for today. And I think your spaceships are going to involve a lot of our flight nurses.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel that the more knowledge you have about education that you have on all these procedures and the space and medicine in space, because I feel that the future is going to be there'll be flight nurses flying patients back and forth. I really do.
Uh-huh. You know, they discovered that they needed y'all in World War II.
And they will find that they will need you.
You know, the program is still going.
That's right.
That says a lot for your ability as, say, one of the flight nurses during World War II to show that the program was worthwhile.
I can't think of anything else unless I'm forgetting. You know, as I said, I'm 65, going to be 66, and I've forgotten a lot more than I knew. And I think, you know, many things that we think about in our youth, we forget later on.
Sure.
And, of course, I think our opinions and our attitudes change as we get older. But I do think the most important thing is for a nurse to be able to have compassion for a fellow man, to have all the education she can get, and to be prepared for that area, whatever it be, whether it's a spaceship or whether it's to go to the South Pacific, the European Theater, to learn all she can about the area and the people and the diseases in that area.
I know we've been talking for, it's not quite not 2 hours yet.
Oh.
And I've asked you some questions, but I wonder if there are other things that you might like to share that I haven't touched on.
What, for instance?
Well, that's why I'm asking you. I don't know.
If you're talking about my personal life, I really did miss my husband. He wrote letters every day. And I wrote letters every day, and I think I had he had a stack of letters about this high when I got home. And he'd say to me, you missed a couple of days. I said, honey, I couldn't write. There were days when we were out on the islands. I said, there was no way I could get mail to you.
Now, this but 6-inch stack, was that letters he had written to you?
Or letters that he had written to me.
Oh,
no, I used to take them out. I didn't have as many. And, of course, then he understood when he realized all, when he saw all the pictures and the things that went on, you know, in the areas.
So you didn't get to write but, quite as often as he may have
No.
Wanted.
But we did, that's about the only time we commuted, and of course I'd write as often as I could, and then of course my family would write to him to find out what he knew, because I would, the only thing I could write and tell him was we couldn't, they would have letters cut up. My sister wrote once to me, and she said to me, well, what is this? She said, every other word is cut out. I said, well, it probably was because I said they decided to censor it.
Yeah, yeah.
We had a lot of that.
Weren't able to give full information.
No, we couldn't give any information. We couldn't tell them. Now, when we had say we were based at Hickam Field, that wasn't even allowed.
Oh, even that much.
That wasn't even allowed.
Because
the only thing that we were allowed to give them was our APO number, which was 903. I still remember that because that was my house number at home in Girard.
But unless they knew. But unless they knew. APO numbers.
Yeah. So I told them before I left that that's probably where it would be. But I said it would be somewhere. I said it would have to be either Australia, New Guinea, or one of the South Pacific Islands. So they knew I was over in the South Pacific, but they did, had no idea where I was stationed or where I'd be or what I was doing.
So if they were writing you, how did they address it? They used the APO number?
APO number, yeah. Okay. And so when I got back to Hickam, whenever I got back there, that's where the mail would be.
So
we never got any mail on the islands. There was no mailman on the islands.
That's a good reason
to go. No telephone, no radios, no nothing on the islands.
I heard Hickam was civilization and the other islands
It was.
Weren't.
They weren't. No, Hickam was a beautiful base. It really was. Very well civilized. They had a beautiful officers' club.
Uh-huh.
Good place to go eat. And we used to go up into the mountains. There was an area. We had a bivouac, and that was another place we had a bivouac. I'll be honest with you, Judy. The whole time I was at Hickam Field and we had a bivouac, in fact, there are some pictures in here of the bivouac, never saw a snake, but it rained. It was like what we call moisture, and the sun would be shining. I can remember one day doing my laundry at Hickam when we came back from a flight, and I stuck it out before I went to bed to sleep. It was 9 o'clock in the morning. The sun was shining pretty, and I put these clothes out and went in there, and I got up about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Apparently, it had just finished raining, and they were sopping wet, and I couldn't believe what happened. Well, here, I guess they dry in about a half hour, though, after. But it rains all the time.
Yeah.
It's a
yeah.
constant moisture. Our bivouac was lots of fun, as I showed you some of the pictures. But in the middle of the night, this lieutenant, who was our bivouac instructor, he got us up at 2 o'clock in the morning. We had dug trenches. We put the tents up and everything. We
so
had
a
break
like
camp.
Field exercise.
This is a field exercise.
Yeah. Yeah.
That bivouac was a field exercise where we had to take our tents up. They shot false artillery and
yeah.
And that we did have, and then we'd pick up our tents and go dig another trench and go put our tents back up again. But we did have a real live obstacle course session one day, and we didn't know that it was alive.
Live as in ammunition.
It was at Louisville. It wasn't at Bowman Field. We had to go to Fort Knox. That's where they had the obstacle course. And we were informed that we were going to have a dry run, what they called a dry run. And we didn't think anything of it. And, of course, we thought, like anything else, it was a lark.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't really a lark when we got through. When he'd say, you know, he'd say to me, and this, we weren't finished with our flight training yet because he called me Joe Melito. And he'd say, stick that ass down on the ground. Excuse me. And he said, you're getting shot at. And, of course, we laughed. We didn't know what we're talking about. And somebody finally said, that's live ammunition.
Oh.
Well, if you didn't see us burrowing with our elbows, laying flat on our bellies, trying to get out of that. And that was a tough obstacle, of course. That was one part of it. And then we had to climb up. You've seen them on Super... Star
yeah,
has it.
About,
oh, it was terrible. I thought I couldn't understand
and
why we had to go through this. I just couldn't believe it.
I have seen some pictures of different partners. I don't know if it was your squadron, through some of
this is probably it, because this obstacle course was the most, it was the most ridiculous thing. I couldn't figure out, why did we have to go through that? Why didn't they just say to us, what would you do, you know, if somebody was shooting at you? Well, naturally, you'd flatten on the ground, or you, if you know ahead of time, you're going to dig a trench.
Yeah.
Like the time in Saipan, I had brought a load of patients in, and they gave me tent number 4, and I went in there to go to sleep. It was in the daytime, and I went to sleep, and nobody called me. They had a alert alarm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
2 tents next to me were bombed. Everybody forgot to call me. The nurse on the army nurse that was there, she said she had completely forgotten that I had come in on a flight. In fact, the photographer gave me a picture later on of my tent right next to it, which one was bombed.
And the others that were bombed, so you could see.
There was nobody in the other two. It's a good thing, because if I had been in one of the others, I would have been gone. And I really, I don't know, it must have been the Lord looking after me. I always said that somebody was there, because when I saw that, I thought, well, that was a frightening experience. That really was, and I don't know whether it's in there, but it's in one of those. Yeah, we can see that. Here it is. There it is. I think it was. Was it Saipan? Yes, I put it in there because I've always kept that.
I see it. Uh huh.
It was dark. Yeah. The light. You know, everything is dark, and they took the photographer. See, they had photography. They had servicemen. You know, they had a service photographers.
Well, yeah. Uh huh. Sometimes that's a military. Yeah. Job.
Yeah, that's what they had, and this is. We didn't have civilian ones, except, as I said, on those 2 flights that
Schedule
I went to. Yeah, on Lady and on Okinawa, we had those.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, they were Army photographers. And they took that picture, and when they found out that I was in that tent, this, still can't remember his name, but he cussed me out. And I said to him, I'm sorry, sir, but I said, I just come in from a flight. I'm to pick up this load of patients in an hour. And I said, I was getting some sleep in. I said, I had no way. I went sound asleep. He said, well, didn't you hear the alert? And I said, no, I didn't. He said, well, half the area is bombed. So he said, your patients that you were going to take back are going to be doubled. And there were a lot of them that were severe casualties.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, when we went swimming one day, that's another thing that happened. We went swimming one day. It had to be in Leyte. And they told us it was a safe area to go swimming. And it was a beautiful area. We went to swimming, and I was out in the water, and I can't remember who the other nurse was. We're out in the water, and she screamed. And I said, what are you screaming about? And she says, come on back in. Well, I come back in, and here I turned around after I come back in, and here's these Japanese bodies. Oh, they were in the water, buried in the water, where we had been swimming. And I thought, oh, my. That's sad. And some of the boys had bought, you know, on the planes, they had bought pictures of Japanese wives and children that they had taken from the Japanese in the scabbards, as I call them, you know, the swords and all these. And I did see one Japanese commit. Is that what you
don't?
We didn't call it Harry Carey. It was, I was on the island when the one ship, also one plane, came down.
I'll have to look that one up.
Yes.
I know which the bomb.
And
the
bomb, yes. But this other,
is
the bomb.
Okay.
Kazukami?
Something like that.
But this one Japanese was an elderly man, and we were feeding a lot of the natives in line this one day, because we'd let them all come out of the islands and feed them. And this was a Japanese, whether he was Japanese born, but he was Japanese, but he lived on the island, and he took the sword and committed suicide. I guess you call it Harry Carey.
Yeah.
It was so sad, right? And we had some native children who committed the same thing, jumped over the cliffs and went down on some of these islands.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there was a lot of that.
A lot of different ways that they did it.
Yeah. These were natives that I'm speaking about. So there were some sad, there were some good times, but there was a lot of sadness at the time, a lot of pain, I think. A lot of pain, and I think this is something that a flight nurse would have to get accustomed to, because she would have to feel the pain, because in order to have any compassion or sympathy for these, she would have to understand and know pain herself, because unless you were there, you would never realize the problems that our boys went through and the problems of the natives in the islands and the Japanese, our enemies, their families, must have gone through the same. Horrible.
This would be part of what you said earlier, knowing about the area to which you're going.
To which you're going, you would have to...
just geographically, but
no,
culturally...
No, culturally, you would have to understand them, yes. Just as we never knew about the natives going topless, and I never thought, you know, and you never dreamt that this was the problem. This lady lived to be 100 and some years old. They told us that's why they got her picture.
This is one of the natives.
Yes, yeah. But I thought the tent. Now this is some of the areas when they were bombed. I have a lot of those in some of the areas. And,
this is Guam.
These are some of the areas of different islands, Tarawa. Now this is a picture of the place where I said, now this photographer was there with me, and he took, these were the where I said about the chief with his tribe,
yes,
lived in this,
I remember that.
This is how they lived. Here's another picture of them, and he took some of them. And what was nice about this, John, the Navy, they would send me the pictures, you know, after they would send them to the, I guess they screened them all and made sure that they were censored.
So you got some additional pictures without having
No, I never had a camera. I didn't take any of these. Except when we were at Hickam, we'd take pictures. So I have a lot of pictures here that really I never took. You know, these were pictures of... see, here's how the Navy had their hospitals, base hospitals.
Okay, these are just some canvas and screen,
maybe. That's all in those islands.
Basic wood frame or something.
That's right. Now this native was on that. I can't think of the island, but we made a stop landing there, and
did they all start
there.
Looking alike sometimes?
Well, they did.
Especially
you know, that's just like I said. All the Japanese always looked alike to me, and I don't know. I think I told you about the plane load of patients that I took out of maybe it was in a wee talk that I had, or lady, one of them, it was Manila, where I had 3 Japanese officers. Did I relate that story to you?
Oh, tell me a little more. No.
There was this, I had took mostly, they were Marines on my plane coming back that were injured, but they weren't severe. I only had 4 litter cases. There were 20 or 18, what we used to call walking patients that had wounds, but they couldn't stay in the bat. They couldn't be on the fighting, so they had to go back for more treatment. We had 3 Japanese. We had picked up 3 Japanese, and they had told me, the flight surgeon, when I took my load of patients on, and I think it was, I want to say Manila, but I'm not sure. It might have been Lady. I can't remember. It was one of the islands that they were, these 3 prisoners were hiding, and they were high. They were officers. The one had to be a colonel in the Japanese army, but they were to be sent back to the United States for interrogation.
Okay, I think we were talking about your flight with the Japanese.
The Japanese. I had 3 Japanese officers as prisoners of war on my flight. Coming back from, I don't remember whether it was Leyte or Manila, but from one of the islands, and I had a group of Marines who were injured on the flight going back as patients. My flight surgeon said to me that the responsibility of their safety was mine.
Of everyone's safety, or was he referring particularly to
He was referring just to the Japanese officers,
okay.
Because as far as the others, he knows that without having to say that the responsibility for every patient's safety is my responsibility.
Right.
But he meant, and I knew he meant, because he said, you do have a gun. And he said to me, you must use that gun. Under no circumstances is anything to happen to those 3 prisoners. Washington is waiting for them.
Uh-huh.
So as I got on the airplane, of course, they had given me some oranges, which we had never seen, and I don't know why, whether it was for the Japanese benefit or whose benefit it was, but there was 4 or 5 oranges in a little basket back here, and a lot of our Marines who had been tortured and killed and wounded by these Japanese, they felt bitter about it, and they didn't feel that they should have to ride in an airplane or take live prisoner back. They would just as soon see some of the atrocities done to them that was done to our boys.
Mm-hmm.
So they kept on saying, Lieutenant, you're needed up front. Lieutenant, you're needed up front. And
this is the Marines.
This is our Marines, our boys, our soldiers.
Uh-huh.
I call them our boys.
Yes.
They laughingly said this to me, and they'd say, take an orange up to the pilot. Uh-huh. The pilot's probably thirsty. He doesn't see oranges very well, and they kept this up. And, of course, this flight was a long flight. It wasn't a safe flight. So when I said to one of the young boys, I said, now, why do you want me to go up front? And he said, we'll take care of your prisoners. I knew when he said, we'll take care of your prisoners, that it wasn't anything good.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So I never left the three prisoners' view. I stayed in their view, and I watched them until I landed with those patients. And believe me, that was a terrifying experience, because I knew the feeling. I could understand our soldiers' feelings, our Marines' feelings, because they had been wounded by these people, and they had been, some of their buddies had been killed, and they probably were very upset that we were taking them back in the airplane alive to be interrogated and then left go free. But I did get them to Guam. That was where I was to get them to. And then from there,
someone else took the responsibility.
Well, it wasn't going to be with a load of patients, though. They would be taken back with somebody else. Mm-hmm. It would be somebody in the attorney general, whatever they have, and, you know, the marshal would have to take them back. But I was to carry the three prisoners back from the island where they were captured.
And you had no additional...
No help. Nobody.
Police
nobody,
or anything like that
nobody on
board.
Nobody on board. It was just my responsibility.
Now, you mentioned carrying a gun. Did
yes.
you carry one on all of them?
No,
missions?
No. The only missions we carried them on was, I remember on Eniwetok, on Okinawa, I carried a gun,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And on Lady, I carried a gun.
And was this something that they had taught you?
Well, because they told us that you use the gun on yourself if you couldn't. Yes, it was kill or be killed. And they said if you were ever captured, this was, of course, drummed into us. If we were ever captured, we were never to let them take us. That was the purpose for the gun.
To not let them take you prisoner.
Not take us prisoners, because he said the atrocities they did to females would have been terrible.
Oh.
So they said you were to use the gun on yourself. Well, can you just see me killing myself? Every time I think about that, Judy, I think, you know, that's a terrible thing to have somebody say to you, now you use this gun on yourself.
Well, you know, you've talked about difficult things during the war, and I would think that having the responsibility for even having the gun and what they expect you to do with it must have been hard to
Well, I would think since it would be today, I think, if I had to deal with it today. But I think, you know, youth is really... they're always liking challenges, and I think, you know, as you get older, you mature and you learn that these things aren't the normal, you know, things to be thinking about. Yes, it is the foolishness of youth, because when I think about it, I think, now how could I ever? I'm saying the rosaries for a safe trip, and then you tell me I have to kill myself. I think I would almost take my chances with the enemy,
yeah.
And that was my philosophy. Yes. Well, I think I've about exhausted my memory bank.
Your store of memories.
Store of memories. I might think of a lot more later on, but I think I've about exhausted it now.
Well, if you think of other things later
on, I'll let you know.
If I find any,
I will. And if I find anything that I think that might be of interest to you, I will let you know. I will send it to you.
Thank you so much for sharing your experiences.
You're quite welcome, and I'm very, very happy to meet you, and I'm glad that I was able to help you in your thesis, and I hope you get your PhD and let me know about it.
I will, and thank you.
Because I really will appreciate it. You're welcome.